Hello, I'm Jeff Hutchison, filling in for Richard today on Conversations. Delighted to be here and to introduce you to philanthropist, businesswoman, and one of this country's living treasures, Janet Holmes Accord. Janet's husband, Robert, was considered Australia's first billionaire businessman. An enigmatic personality, he was in the 1980s part of an extraordinarily dynamic business clique in this country, where it seemed the thrill of the chase seemed to matter almost as much as the value of the prize, and what prizes and businesses were bought and sold along the way by the Packers, the Bonds, the Brearleys, the Elliots, and of course Holmes Accords. But Robert's early death at the age of 53 not only robbed Janet of a husband and the father of their four children, she was left with a shaky business empire to first stabilise and then manage. That Janet Holmes Accord appears to have done so with such skill and style might belie the enormity of the challenge. Hi, Janet.
Hi, Jeff.
Lovely to have you here. I wonder if we can begin with one of your earliest memories. Your family are living in Swanview Road in Greenmount in the late 1940s, and you're walking with Dad down to the station to pick up something. What was it?
Yes, my parents had just built a new house. It must have been 1946 or 7, and my mother had ordered plants. We had about half an acre of garden, and my mother had ordered plants from the Hamel Nursery south of Perth, and my father and I went to the train station to pick them up, and there was a... The main plant I remember was a Eucalyptus citriodora, which is still one of my favourite trees, a lemon-scented gum. But Mum had ordered native plants, which was quite an
unusual
thing to do at that time. Mm.
Tell me about the lemon-scented gums. Have you seen them since?
The biggest of the lemon-scented gums, and maybe there was only one, but the largest of those, as far as I know, is still growing beautifully, because often when I fly back from Melbourne or Sydney, we fly over Swanview Road, and if I look out the window from the left-hand side of the plane, I could see that lemon-scented gum.
Your house backed onto National Park.
Yes.
Were you the kind of kid that splashed around in creeks?
Oh, definitely. We had an idyllic childhood there. The back fence of our property was the western boundary of the John Forrest National Park. We spent many, many hours building dams in the creek. Might be part of the reason I'm interested in construction and engineering. We built really fantastic dams. But we also spent hours walking through the bush, looking at wildfowl, searching for them, but never being allowed to pick them. That was a big no-no as far as my mother was concerned.
You could look for them, but you couldn't pick them.
No.
Why?
I think she was an environmentalist long before we started calling people environmentalists, but she believed, A, that wildflowers looked much better in the bush than in a jam jar crammed together sitting on the top of someone's fridge, and she also believed that we should leave them there so that they could seed or propagate in whatever way they did, so that we admired them in the bush but we left them there.
Tell me about Mum and Dad.
They were terrific parents. They were very political. For a few years they were members of the Communist Party, believing that there was a better way, and they were born during the First World War, or just before. They'd lived through the Depression in the 30s. They were not happy with the political situation they found themselves in, and I think the Communist Party offered a solution which they at the time thought would be a better way of living, a better way of doing things. A few years later, of course, they realised that wasn't necessarily so. And my mother actually left the party first The leader of the Communist Party in Western Australia was the great writer Catherine Susanna Pritchard. And Catherine would not brook any discussion or argument that communism was the way to go and we won't have any discussion about it. And my mother was not convinced that that was absolutely right, and she certainly didn't respect anyone who wouldn't have a conversation about it.
Did your mum like to debate ideas?
Yes, she did. Yes, she did, she, as did my father. And they had an interesting group of friends. Interestingly, the communists who were in the party at that time, with whom we mixed and socialised, were nearly all doctors. They were medical doctors based in, most of them practising in Midland Junction, which was a pretty low income area. Lots of them did lots of their work for nothing or in exchange for watermelons or a bottle of wine from the Yugoslavs in the Swan Valley and so on.
So when your parents, when your parents expressed an interest in what communism might provide, it was about fairness for all. Was that the underlying value?
That was the, that would have been the underlying value. I mean, I was quite young, so I didn't really have conversations with them, but I saw the very seductive magazines and so on, New China or, you know, something like that. I can't remember quite what the titles were, but they were, you know, working people being respected and boosted. And
what are your recollections then as a girl, perhaps, of your parents and their friends, or were there certain outings? I know you used to go to the pictures, but it wasn't necessarily to see a Hollywood movie.
No, well, we didn't go very often, and probably it's built up enormously in my mind ever since. But I do remember the first movie I ever saw was a stunning film, a Russian film of Don Quixote, and was it was very beautiful in that in the use of colour, the cinematography was pretty fantastic. And the support film for that was about beavers, a documentary about beavers. And, I mean, it captures a child's imagination.
To what extent would your parents have had to be discreet about their views and their friendship circle?
Oh, very discreet. Very discreet, because that was at a time when there was a potential for the Communist Party to be banned. In fact, I think it's one of the great moments in Australian history that when there was a referendum on whether the Communist Party should be banned or not, Australians voted against that, which is, in the Cold War, in the light of the fact that we're in the Cold War, it's quite an astonishing fact that Australians
would, I think, vote you're proud of that.
Well, I'm proud of it on behalf of Australians, that they would think and work this out. So there was a need to be discreet, and it wasn't only for my parents, it was for my brother and I. We didn't talk about what we'd been doing at the weekend. And
were your parents watched? Was the house ever raided by whichever agency had responsibility for keeping an eye on the commos?
I don't know whether we were ever raided, but we certainly received messages from my father's. I can remember one coming from Dr. Alec Jolly saying they're on the way. And we had an old Ford Prefect under the back seat of which was a wooden box, and Dad could hide Communist Party literature in that. I mean, hilarious. One of my friends, Peter Dowding, has accessed the ASIO records on his father, and they are so full of rubbish and lies that I'm tempted to see what's in there about my parents, but I haven't actually gone that far yet.
Did it ever cause your parents any distress? Or was their belief strong and consequently this was part of the deal?
I'm not sure about that. I mean, they probably thought it was hilarious. I mean, fancy, you know, a couple in living in Swanview Road in Greenmount being under suspicion of being spies or whatever just because they happened to meet with Catherine Susanna and people like that.
You mentioned Catherine Susanna Pritchard as being very central to the Communist Party, as she was in Australia, and that your mother found her slightly overbearing, but she gave you something of value, didn't she? What was it that the great novelist gave Janet?
She actually gave me two things. One of them was a book about, it was a Russian book, and it was called The Diary of a School Teacher. And it was obviously translated into English. And I think it was possibly the inspiration for me to become a teacher. I just loved that book. The other thing which she gave me, which has really come back into my life now, is she gave me a friendship with her granddaughter. So whenever her granddaughter, Karen, who lived in Canberra with her parents, came to Perth, because we were roughly the same age, I would be called to play and amuse Karen. And we were firm friends, but it didn't last very long because once my parents left the Communist Party, boom, we had nothing more to do at that house. But 60 years later, I have found Karen again. And like her grandmother, she's a writer living in Victoria. And recently came to Perth and we met up again after seriously 60 years. And it was quite interesting because we felt as if there hadn't been a 60-year gap. We had very similar thoughts on all sorts of subjects. And
and you could laugh at the old ways.
Yes, yes. So that was a very nice thing that Catherine gave me, as well as the book.
Mm. Were you good at school?
Well, boasting, yeah, I was, but but I was at a very small. Greenmount was a three-teacher school with I have no idea how many children, but it probably would only have been 60 max in the all seven grades of primary school. So it's not a huge achievement to be top of the class in a school like that.
Sure, but you then went to Perth Mod.
I then went
where your dad had been.
That's right. My father was determined that I would get to modern school, and he coached me quite a bit because our headmaster at Greenmount School was a delightful man, but he was extremely interested in poetry and folk dancing, and we did a lot of both of those. So Dad coached me a bit in maths and so on, which I did inherit a natural flair for, I suppose. And so I won a scholarship to modern school, and I have often thought that was a great thing because possibly if I'd gone to the local high school, I may have been top of the class again. That wouldn't have been very good for me.
Your folk dancing would have been good, though.
The folk dancing would have been. But, you know.
It mattered to your dad, though, didn't it? Because the impression I get of him, that he went to Perth Mod like a lot of people, war intervened and interrupted lives.
Yeah.
And he worked for AMP and did for his whole working life?
He did. And that was a great, well, I suppose it's the classic way people operated in those days. He felt the AMP had been very generous to him and his friends, taking them straight from school based on their school qualifications. When they came back from the war, they went back to the AMP. They all should have gone to university from there, but they were loyal to the AMP because, quote, the AMP looked after us in the Depression, so we'll stick with them. He wasn't mad about his job, and he, because of his political leanings, he didn't advance as far as he should probably, but people did that then.
They did. Mm. He wanted you to go to Perth Mod, and from what I gather, and of course Perth Mod has a fantastic reputation today still, it wasn't just about getting the leaving equivalent, it was about winning exhibitions. So there was expectation, wasn't there?
Oh, there was huge expectation from the staff there, that we were not there just to pass our junior, as it was called then, or the leaving. We were there to work extremely hard and win exhibitions, win a good place into the university.
Yours sounds like a household that certainly was filled with ideas and conversations and debate. And understand there's plenty of classical music and absolutely no Elvis Presley.
No, no Elvis Presley. Thank goodness for the ABC, because there was, I think it was 6WN even. I think U720 is the equivalent of 6WF.
That's right.
Well, we were 6WN, which
the classical
was classical music.
Music all
the way. Mm. And my parents at a very early age took me to hear the Wasso. In the various iterations and the various venues where they played at that time. And there was a lot of music. And, of course, I learnt the piano for 15 years or something.
I sense that this is an intellectual household, appreciation of fine and important things. But having said that, it seemed that they were happy enough for you to get your hands dirty when required. Tell me about your first paying job, because I think it's of a very young roustabout, isn't it?
Yes. We used to spend the August holidays each year with friends on a wheat and sheep farm outside of Meriden. And one year when we arrived, the shearers were there and their roustabout hadn't turned up. So age 9, I said, well, I could do that. So I did for a week.
What were you doing?
I was picking up what are called the dags, with the special two planks of wood joined together at the end with a piece of leather, picking up the – they were called dags, actually.
They were.
Yes.
We know what they are.
You know what they are.
Yeah.
And sweeping up after the shearers, there was someone there who would collect the fleece and throw it over the table and so on. And I'd race in and clean that up.
What'd they pay you for it?
I think they paid me, if I recall rightly, about 9 shillings for the week's work. And the two shearers, who were, I think, probably quite young, were given the task of taking me to the Meriden show. Can you imagine? They probably loathed every minute of it. But that was my payment, to go to the Meriden show with two shearers and 9 shillings to spend.
This is Conversations with Geoff Hutchison on ABC Radio.
Janet, you're destined to be a teacher. You go to university, you're very involved in the student guild, and at some point someone says to you, there is this nice guy who's arrived from South Africa and you must meet him. Can you describe that nice guy to me?
Yes, I can. He was very tall. He was wearing a suit, and lots of the law students actually did wear suits to university in those days. They weren't scruffy like science students where I was with whom I was working, he was about 7 years older than I was, so he was quite a bit older than all.
He was a man
who was older than all the students. He had a very nice car. He had a car. That was a plus.
Yes.
and he had a beautiful voice. And so I thought that, yes, that's a very interesting person. Then I didn't have very much to do with him until he was elected to a – I was secretary of the Guild Council by this stage, and he was elected to a position, the representative to the National Union of Students. And I had to go to the phone and ask him to – ring him and ask him to come down and join the meeting. And I thought at the time – that's a really nice voice. And he always said that he thought at the time, I must remember to marry that girl someday, which I laugh at because it's so Robert. I mean, maybe he should have thought, I wonder if she would like to marry me one day.
In a moment, I will ask why you chose to marry him. But you worked very closely on the Guild Council for a couple of years, and there is evidence of that in the Guild Minutes, isn't there? This is funny.
There is evidence of that. Lots of motions moved Holmes Court, seconded Ranford, which was my maiden name, but also a few where it was moved Holmes Court, seconded Ranford, and then I'd vote against it.
Why?
I would think, you know, I would say if I were being untruthful, I'd say it's because I'd considered the matter, you know, in great detail and decided I'd made a mistake. Or I might say, you know, perhaps I seconded the motion so I could hear the discussion, but it was probably that I just forgot that I'd seconded, but I'd done it so automatically.
It wasn't to prick his balloon at all.
Oh, never. No, I
truly never.
Truly never. No, I never, ever, ever did that. I don't think I'm very good at pricking anybody's balloon. You know, I don't think it's. Did I? Maybe I've talked about that, but I don't think I would willfully try to prick anyone's balloon.
Why did you marry Robert Holmes Accord?
I was obsessed by him. I absolutely was obsessed by him. I really adored the man.
Handsome?
Oh, look, if you're in love with someone, you have no idea whether they're handsome. If you're a man and you're in love with a woman, you have no idea whether they're plain, beautiful, ugly,
it's just
attractive.
Love.
It's you have no
ideas
about that. You know, you see lots of very handsome men in your life and you have no attraction to them whatsoever, but the one you're really attracted to becomes handsome to you.
When did he propose or just demand that you married him? Because clearly he intended this sometime earlier.
Yeah, I can't remember, but it was a long time before we did get married because I had this idea in my head that he was a confirmed bachelor and we'd never get married. So it was a long time between drinks, if you like.
Did your parents like him?
They grew to like him. They liked him, but they didn't love him. They didn't quite understand someone coming from such a different background. And I think they were concerned.
Was he a cool character?
He was, yes, yes, yeah.
And that can be hard to read sometimes and maybe hard to warm to sometimes?
Yes, maybe. And that's why I guess when, you know, when he became successful in business, people often said that I was the human face of the relationship.
Do you think that's true?
Well, I used to say I'm the class clown. But it was true too, because he was shy, he was very reserved, he was quiet, and all those things don't describe me. None of those things describe me, so I could, you know, make the cups of tea for people or make shareholders at shareholders' meetings feel comfortable by schmoozing them.
Always at ease. You played the role of the partner at ease,
yeah,
to put others at their ease.
Yes, yeah.
You do get married and then you go back to Perth Mod to teach science. And you have a couple of really good years there and you are expecting a third really good year because you're thinking, I actually can teach chemistry to these kids. And then the principal kind of cuts that away from you. What did he say to you?
Yes, I'd had a year and a half and then got married and finished the second year of teaching. The third year I went back and my timetable was shown to me and it was teaching subjects I had no idea about, geography to 311 or something. And the headmaster's excuse was that now that I was married, I was not trustworthy and I might have a baby and leave, so I couldn't be trusted with the final year students. And I was very disappointed.
Janet, was your husband a hard man to know? And I ask because last year your son Peter went back to Zimbabwe, the place of Robert's birth, in search of some history. And he said this, "While I do know lots of things about him, lots about what he did, the companies he bought and who he bothered, I have come to realise that I know very little about him as a person, and I am not alone. Even when I talk to people who worked closely with him, the description enigma is what comes up most frequently."
I think that's very accurate, what Peter has said. Many, many people who worked with Robert have no idea. His secretary had one secretary for his whole working life, from an article clerk to when he died. And when Patricia Edgar wanted to write a book about Robert, she couldn't, because she couldn't find enough information about it, so it ended up being about Janet. She asked Val Pittman about certain aspects, and Val's answer was always, oh, he didn't talk to me about that. They talked about work. She typed, he dictated, she organised appointments, she answered the phone, but they didn't have a relationship where he would discuss anything personal.
On air, online, and on your mobile. This is Conversations with Jeff Hutchison on ABC Radio.
My guest today is Janet Holmes-Accord, and we've been learning a little about her enigmatic, there's that word coming up again and again, enigmatic husband, Robert. What we haven't yet talked about was the environment in which he was doing business in the Australia of the 1980s. And Janet, it does seem to me that there was no business prize of value your husband or others did not consider buying. Is that accurate?
Oh, yes, I think so. I don't think they were frightened of anything. I can remember being at the airport waiting to catch a flight to Melbourne or Sydney, and Robert said to me, oh, go and get someone in the office on the phone. I've just thought of a company we could buy. And that was answered. And then another fellow, John Reynolds, who worked for Robert for a long time, still has a $50 note that he won from Robert, because Robert said to him one morning, I've thought of a company we could buy, but you'll never guess. And John thought, well, the most stupid idea in the world would be to buy BHP. So he said, BHP? And Robert said, yes. And John still has the $50 note that he won. He wasn't frightened of anyone.
He tried to buy Carlton and United Breweries, mm-hmm. the Herald and Weekly Times. Mm-hmm. You mentioned BHP. You've mentioned mm-hmm. Ansett. He had an interest in buying Rolls-Royce, I think.
Yep.
Brilliant racehorses, probably a few slow ones. Mm-hmm. Cattle stations in the Northern Territory. Theatres in London. What can you tell us about the portfolio? What mattered in this portfolio?
The portfolio was diverse, to say the least. The theatres in London were not the specific target at that particular time. It was a company called, I think it was called ACC, Associated Communications, and it was about owning television stations in the UK. And it came with the film division, where we made films like Sophie's Choice, can you believe, and On Golden Pond, etc. But it also had the theatres in it. Robert was with companies like BHP and Ansett. It definitely was the thrill of the chase, but also the feeling that he could change them for the better. And with BHP, say, he was thinking about writing a book about BHP called Colour It Grey, because he felt the company had got so big and moribund, and maybe, you know, it needed some changes to be made. And in fact, lots of the changes that he would have proposed have in fact been done. The company's been, you know, divided up into different areas and so on.
He bring to these things? What was his business gift?
Well, in most cases, he didn't achieve the goal, so he didn't have the chance to bring very much. But I do know when he was on the board of BHP for a very short time, some of the BHP executives told me they absolutely loved him being there, because he had done the homework. He'd read the board papers. He knew what was going on and asked good questions that challenged them. At that time, there were a very small number of board members who were on dozens of boards, and I think they probably woke up and thought, well, today it's Tuesday, it must be BHP, sure. Tomorrow morning will be Westpac, then it's NAB and whatever. So being a total outsider with a totally different view was very, challenging but satisfying for the senior executives in some of these organisations. The really senior executives, of course, hated it.
You mention very lightly, and you strike me as an incredibly modest person. You do. You mention very lightly, we made films, Sophie's Choice, on Golden Pond, as if it's something that I made as well last week. What was it like to be part of this adventure? When did you like it the most? When was it at its most thrilling?
Oh, I could never, ever say that. I could never, ever imagine any moment. I mean, that was very exciting to make a film like Sophie's Choice. And I remember seeing the first version or rushes or whatever you call them and crying for days. I just at the decision and the choice which Sophie had to make in that story. So that was, and it was the first time my attention had been drawn to Meryl Streep, and her role in that was so brilliant. So that was exciting. But going to Phantom of the Opera, or we went to Chile to look at the Escondida project when Rob was on the board of BHP. I was devastated because I was not allowed to go. The wives were sent off to do shopping and have lunch. And coming from a science background, I was dying to see the geological formations that had inspired them. And we went to Chuquicamata, visited there, which is the biggest copper mine in the world, with absolutely no consideration for the environment whatsoever. We got there at the crack of dawn and all we could hear was people coughing because there was so much sulfur in the air. But I would love to have seen that. So that was an exciting moment to be in Chile looking at this stuff but not being allowed to look at it.
So not necessarily wooed by the flim-flam of perhaps celebrity and who you might meet. I don't think those things mattered to you very much.
No, they didn't matter to me at all.
All right, Robert brings Michael Jackson to Western Australia to perform at Telethon.
That was a very sad moment, actually, because Michael Jackson came to Perth for Telethon but not to perform at Telethon because, you may remember, he was not allowed under his recording deals and management deals and so on to actually perform. But he did visit the children's hospital and was marvellous with the kids. He asked me to take him shopping. He wanted to buy some books. We went to antique bookshops and he bought 19th century medical textbooks that had gruesome pictures of skin diseases in them, which I guess he wanted to use for, you know, ideas for makeup for various things he made. But he was a very, very sad little boy and he attached himself to me. And when at the end of Telethon, Robert said to him, Michael, you will have to come. You can't, you know, I know you can't perform, but you'll have to be seen to be there because we've brought you all this way and everyone wants to see you there. And this sounds sort of arrogant, doesn't it? But he said, I'll go if Janet can come with me. And so I stood next to Michael at the finale at Telethon and he held on to my hand and he kept saying, this is so embarrassing. This is so embarrassing. And it was staggering, really, to think of this young man who would perform to 100,000 people and do the astonishing dancing and singing and leaping about that he did. But to be in a small group, he was just a little boy.
How extraordinarily fragile.
Ah.
But you know that about people. I think
you've
met enough people to know that how some present is not who they are.
That's right. And if they presented who they were, no one would be interested.
You talked about, that's an interesting observation too, you talked about the thrill of the chase. How did Robert get on with Alan Bonds and John Elliott's and to a lesser extent Kerry Packer? I think Kerry Packer was not a man who particularly liked being out there, being a centre of attention, but certainly Alan Bond and John Elliott did.
He didn't get on with them at all. In fact, on the memorial that we built for him at Heytesbury Stud, we carved into the timber a quote from Lord Byron, which says he walked among them but not with them in a cloud of thoughts which were not their thoughts. And that sums him up.
Was he like that with you?
No, he wasn't. He was a bit, I suppose there was a, it was a pretty special relationship, but he actually wanted me to be with him all the time. Sometimes at night he'd be on the telephone and I would be so tired and I would say, you know, give a signal, I'm going to go to bed. And he'd say, no, just come sit here. So one of my memories of my marriage is being terribly tired a lot of the time. But he wasn't. And that it sort of influenced the way, I guess it influenced our children in a way because he wanted me to be with him all the time. I travelled with him all the time and the children went to boarding school. So I had this theory that, you know, if you wanted to have a long and happy marriage and still be together after the children have left home and flown the coop and so on and become independent, then you look after the man, the husband, number one, and the children, number two. Well, as it happened, that was a bit of a stupid idea because he died and I'd spent my time with him.
On ABC Radio, this is Conversations with Jeff Hutchison.
In 1990, the early hours of Father's Day, you lose him at the age of 53 to a heart attack. Now, you've told me previously there was little opportunity to grieve then because there was business to attend to. But I wonder, all these years on, what did you indeed lose that morning?
Well, my God, I lost a husband, a friend, a partner, a lover, father of my children's kids, father of my children, rock. Just my world fell apart.
And yet, there was no time for your world to fall apart because you had business to attend to, and part of that was the fact that Robert died without a will.
Yes, I knew he didn't have a will, but one of the great motivating factors was that Heytesbury had about 1,000 people working for it at that time. That by that time the public company life had gone. We were in a private company situation, and there were around 700 people in the theatres in London and a few hundred on the cattle stations and so on and so on. And they were all devastated. And because of the ABC again, and I think the ABC does the most astonishing job for Australians, but because of the ABC, the people on the cattle stations knew that Robert was dead long before anybody else, because the first thing they do is turn on the ABC when they wake up in the mornings, and the news was out that he'd died. And they were ringing each other and saying, well, that's it then. You know, we're all out of a job. I don't know why they would have thought like that. But I heard that, and so, you know, you just had to let them know that everything was going to be all right, despite the fact that, A, there was no will, and a particular journalist who worked for Robert put out a press release saying that I would be taking over with the assistance of my son, Peter, and nothing wrong with Peter except that he was 21 and the banks to whom we owed hundreds of millions of dollars had been through the experience of Warwick Fairfax and the Fairfax demise.
Yes.
And they did not want any 21-year-olds next to, in any way involved with the company. So the first thing that had to be done was an arrangement had to be put in place where I had the voting shares. So if you die without a will, and I don't recommend it to anybody, but if you do, your spouse will inherit 1/3 of the estate and your children 2/3 of the estate. So the banks were concerned, A, because it had been announced that Pete would be helping me, but B, because the children had 2/3 of the company. So we had to put something in place that gave me all the voting shares.
How quickly, Janet? Because clearly much depends on these things, and yet you've lost your husband, and perhaps what you want is solitude.
Yeah, that there wasn't much of that. No, there wasn't any of that. But you do what you have to do, don't you, in life? And I guess I have thought often that life is about handling disappointment very much. How do you handle disappointment? How do you handle these things? And sometimes you handle them with great thought. Other times you just leap in because something has to be done. And frankly, that's what I did. I leapt in. If I'd known as much as I know now about business, I probably would have thought, don't be ridiculous, woman.
You have previously said that Robert stood at the top of a business pyramid. Mm-hmm. And when you took over that business, you inverted the pyramid. Can you explain what that means?
Yes, well, I think Robert was at the top of a pyramid because he was extremely, I think he was extremely charismatic. He was extremely clever. He was a great thinker and planner. And he really, I knew, controlled everything that Heytesbury ever did. People didn't buy shares unless Robert had rung them in the morning and said, buy some shares. And so he was at the top of a pyramid with everyone else paying homage, if you like. I turned the pyramid upside down because really I was a ex-school teacher, and a housewife and a supporter of this amazing man, but I didn't have the business skills. And I think one of the first things that leaders have to learn is to surround themselves with really clever people. And you can't do that if you're at the top of the pyramid, or I didn't feel it. I felt my role was to be at the bottom of the pyramid with all these amazing, you know, people above me, and that I would bubble away and inspire them to do their best and encourage them and so on. So that was how I approached it.
When did you feel in control, or did you not quite feel in control?
No, I don't think I ever really felt totally in control. I can remember one moment where I felt that everything was okay, and just by a sort of coincidence, I was in a meeting in the AMP, in our boardroom in the AMP building, and I found myself surrounded by women who were executives in Heytesbury, all better educated than I was, all better dressed, all more beautiful, all younger, all more intelligent. And I thought, oh, wow, I can sit back and relax a bit because these women were fantastic. And I can remember that feeling coming over me. How good is that? Mm.
That is a real tribute to your judgment and not an anxious ego.
Oh, no, I don't think I have that.
I once asked you if you'd ever considered remarrying, and I think you said to me at the time, just as Kerry Packer said, you only ever get one Alan Bond in your lifetime. There was only ever, for you, one Robert. This is an intrusive question. Can you tell me what it is like to have lived the last 23, 24 years without him?
That's a very hard question, because the reality is that he did die, okay? So to spend 24 years being miserable and agonizing over that is not, I don't think it's A, a good idea, or B, healthy, or what he would have wanted.
Yes.
I mean, the way he lived his life would indicate that he didn't expect to live all that long. So he wouldn't have expected people to mourn for 25 years, which is about the same length of time we were together. And I suppose it freed me to do other things which I wouldn't necessarily have done. And that's a negative for me, but it's the reality that I probably wouldn't be chairing the board of the WASO had he still been alive. It hasn't been all beer and Skittles, and especially in the beginning when we were just so, in so much strife with all those banks and so much to worry about. Yeah, I've weathered that storm, if you like.
You talked about your role with WASO, and I remember a couple of years ago looking back at the boards and the committees and the societies of which you are either chairperson or ambassador or patron. So we have these very sophisticated business links. Then we also have you as ambassador and patron. Literally, there are dozens of them, ranging from the association with the WA Symphony Orchestra to your leadership of the Australian Children's Television Foundation to being a patron of the Pinjarra Race Club. Janet Holmes-Accord, are you a sucker for a good cause?
Completely, but I'm learning. I'm learning to say no. I'm a sucker, but for a good cause. But there are some good causes that are even gooder than others.
They're not good causes; the actual absolute priorities, aren't they?
Priorities and passions. At the moment, one of the things I'm talking with quite a few people about is the treatment of asylum seekers by Australia. And realising that there are people from all walks of life and all political backgrounds and all religious backgrounds who are deeply concerned. And we are meeting to try to find out what on earth we can do about it.
Do you think the inhumane has become acceptable if you sell it to people a certain way?
Oh, yes, definitely.
And does that worry you?
Very, very much. I don't quite know how we got to be here as a nation. I have sometimes thought maybe we've always been here as a nation, and that's an awful thought and one that I hope's not true. A friend of mine has just returned from Lebanon. They have 4 million Lebanese people, and 1.5 million refugees and asylum seekers, which is a bit like Australia having 6 or 7 million people on our doorstep. It's not a major problem for us in this country, but it's been turned into something quite hateful and embarrassing.
It's not the Australia you love?
It's not the Australia that I feel proud of. And one of my friends the other day said, I feel like a stranger in my own country.
What kind of role will there be for you to speak out on such things? I know you feel very strongly about the Republican issue. That is one where Janet Holmes-Accord can stand up and say, I believe in a Republican cause, but I have great respect and regard for the Queen. This is much more politically charged.
Yes.
Will you do the speaking, or will others do it with you?
It's extremely difficult because in many instances, many hundreds of people who signed our advertisement, which we put in the West Australian a few weeks ago, not in our name, we headed it, many of those people are involved in organisations that receive government funding, and we frankly feel compromised. we feel frightened that if we speak out too strongly against the government, and it's not the government only. I mean, the Labor Party.
Absolutely, this is the political mainstream that's made this decision.
Absolutely, it's not against either side of politics. If we speak out too strongly, do we jeopardise our organisations and their funding? And that's a bad place to be. That's Germany 1930s, if you like.
You've got kids who live all over the place. I think one's in Perth, the other in Melbourne, New York, London. You're a grandmother to 16 kids. Are there some things that your mum and dad gave you that you hope your grandchildren might believe in too?
Yes, there are. Many things, actually. I think and hope that they will all be interested in the environment. And I know that many, many of them are. I would like them to be able to coexist and be able to relate to people from all walks of life, all colours, all religions. I would like them to be deeply offended by war, and I would like them to, be decent citizens and work for the betterment of everyone in our community.
Thank you very much for joining me today.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.